So before I begin, I'd like to make a general acknowledgement to the room. As Stefano mentioned, a couple of weeks ago I came to the end of my doctoral studies here, and I'm pleased to be in a room full of a lot of people who've been of a lot of help and great support over the last however many years, I don't like to think, that this has taken. But so before I'd like to begin, I'd like to express how battling through a project like this in Oxford has been made possible and all the more joyous because of a community of friends, teachers and colleagues, both at the Oriental Institute and, of course, the Centre for Buddhist Studies, which I hope obviously continues to go from strength to strength. With that done, I offer a little apology because textual studies such as mine don't necessarily result in presentations full of many entertaining diagrams or inspiring pictures. Rather, they tend to be a little bit text-heavy, and that is the case here. However, it's my hope that some of the material we're going to read is suitably shocking for Buddhologists, that it'll keep us going for about 50 minutes or so. And moreover, I'm going to focus on a couple of narrative passages that found their way to the front of my research, which I think may prove a little bit more entertaining. So, good. My research has concerned the Mahayana Tathagatagarbha literature, or what is sometimes called also the Buddha nature tradition. This pertains to a collection of Indian texts, predominantly sutra literature, which espouse the doctrine that within the constitution of all sentient beings, there is some content that is properly the already awakened nature of a Buddha. I could talk at length about different renderings of the compound Tathagatagarbha, denoting either the embryo or womb of a Tathagata or Buddha, sometimes designating beings themselves or some content within them. But my work is dominated by early texts in this tradition, which hold it to be synonymous with the term Buddha Dhatu, that is, the element or nature of a Buddha that is some significant content in beings. Hence, this is the Tathagatagarbha most frequently understood in its Tibetan translation as the Dashen Shekpe Nyingpo, that is, the essence of a Buddha within beings. What prevents the manifestation of this nature, already replete with the qualities of an awakened being, is its congruence with adventitious mental afflictions, that is, greed, hatred, desire, and so on, which conceal this and constitute the rest of the makeup of any sentient being. These afflictions removed, the Tathagatagarbha authors hold, there is then nothing left but an awakened Buddha. This model for understanding both the constitution of sentient beings and indeed their arrival at awakening is certainly at odds with more conventional Indian Buddhist models, Mahayanist or otherwise. Regarding sentient beings, the Tathagatagarbha literature makes little recourse to categories such as the five skandhas, those constituents that in other Buddhist literature are the exhaustive makeup of any being. Furthermore, awakening is here understood as the purification of something that's already fully developed in one's character, unchanging and permanent. A model that may appear to downplay, for example, the need of any kind of diligence in practice for the bodhisattva. However, I've been examining a further, perhaps even more contentious feature of this literature, that is, its dalliance with the language of selfhood to designate this permanent and superlatively qualified content. So first of all on screen is a neat little example of the kind of language to which I'm referring. This is from the earlier Chinese and then the Tibetan translations of the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, a text which we'll be spending some more time with shortly. So, reading the Chinese, the Buddha said to Kashyapa, that is his main interlocutor in the text, "The true self is the nature of a Tathagata, or the Tathagata Dhatu. One should know that sentient beings all have this, but those sentient beings being covered by measurable afflictions, it is not manifested." You'll notice as well that the Tibetan rendering of the same passage features in quick succession the mention of the self, which is the Tathagatagarbha, which is also the Buddha Dhatu, all of these things seeming to be more or less synonymous. So in some texts of this tradition, dated no later than the early 5th century, the Buddha nature is referred to as a self, or sometimes the true self. The room, I'm sure, is well aware that the wider and, of course, older Buddhist tradition in India was generally characterized by the rejection of the existence of the self, that is, some permanent, unchanging, autonomous ego amidst the conditioned factors classified under the five skandhas, physical form, feelings, perceptions, so on. My interest is not whether or not the Tathagatagarbha authors taught anything that might implicitly suggest the adoption of some self, or this constituent in beings. Rather, I'm interested in the lexical innovation of just some sutra texts, those that declare that the Buddha's own teaching is that of a self. Why did some authors very clearly and very knowingly adopt a discourse that provoked contention among their audiences and evoked comparison with other non-Buddhist religious teachings? I consider this to be an example of Buddhist authors engaging in a discourse surrounding the existence or absence of the self, which might be called an atmavada. I make a distinction between this and the more conventional Buddhist discourse, perhaps a unique feature of Buddhism in India, which is that engaging in a discourse about persons making no recourse to the category of a lasting self, what we could call an anatmavada. The important point here is that for Buddhist authors, the matter is not whether there exists something that warrants the label Atman in beings, but rather that this constitutes something of a category mistake to think in such terms. Beings are better conceived as the products of impersonal processes constituted exhaustively by the ever-changing content of the skandhas. But some Tathagatagarbha authors, otherwise well-versed in the categories and conventions of Buddhist Dharma, indeed present a model of beings in which there exists something that they wish to call a self. It has been suggested that this could represent some concessional drift into un-Buddhist territory, perhaps signs of the encroachment of Brahmanical proto-Vedantic thought into the imaginations of our authors. However, said authors remain adamant that their doctrine, despite using the term Atman, is conversant with how the Buddha properly sees beings, all of whom have the potential for awakening precisely because they have this pure nature. Having surveyed the use of the term Atman across this literature, it is my opinion that in the likely earliest forays into Atmavada discourse, the intention of our authors is slightly different. I argue that the debt of this literature to ideas found in an earlier Mahayana text, namely the Saddhama Pundarika, or commonly simply Lotus Sutra, helps to clarify a particular Buddhological model shared by all of these authors. In this model, the idea that the Buddha, here a transcendent, cosmically influential pedagogue, taught a doctrine of the self is used to expand the boundaries of the Dharma beyond what was previously thought by Buddhist audiences. In short, the resemblance between extraneous religious ideas about the self exists only due to the Buddha's own earlier doctrine of the self, and moreover, these extraneous ideas persist only, it seems, because he in some way wills it. So we have on screen here a list of those texts central to this discussion, most of which, but not all, comprise what we might call a Tathagatagarbha corpus proper, that is, texts certainly of Indian origin, in which this doctrine is affirmed and advanced, but without the term Tathagatagarbha being employed as an epithet for another category, for example, the Alaya Vijnana in Yogacara thought. There are a couple of texts, the Lankavatara and Mahayana Suchalamkara, that do this, but are still somehow involved in this discussion about a Buddhist self. The arrows indicate evidence we have that one text knew of how another used the term Atman or some derivatives in regard to the Tathagatagarbha, sometimes through direct quotation, brief mention of a text by name, or compelling evidence that one text in some way responds to or develops material present in another. As is apparent, it's beyond doubt that the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra and its material dealing with the doctrine of a true self, some of which we saw a moment ago, is known to virtually all of these, and is very likely the main innovative presence in this teaching of a Buddhist self. I bracket at the top of this the one text that doesn't espouse the Tathagatagarbha doctrine at all, that is, once again, the Lotus Sutra, but as I suggest, it can help to make sense of much that is said, some of the stranger things said, throughout the rest of this literature. Over a decade ago, Michael Zimmermann argued convincingly that the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, then thought the earlier of these texts, was strongly indebted to the Saddhama Pundarika Sutra. Indeed, that its doctrine of a fully developed Tathagata within all beings was a development of the pronouncement in the Lotus Sutra that all beings could, and indeed would someday, necessarily attain Buddhahood. But it's only recently been suggested, and convincingly argued, that the Tathagatagarbha Sutra is most likely not an early Tathagatagarbha text at all. Michael Radich has presented persuasively the view that this very tightly structured text, confident in its pronouncements and eschewing these more contentious forms of Tathagatagarbha that we're discussing today, should post-date the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra and possibly some other texts we have on screen also. The texts shown in red are those most central to this study. These are three texts that espouse the Tathagatagarbha called very much specifically a self or true self, in contrast always to other wrong-minded notions of the self that can be found in other religio-philosophical systems, of which these texts seem very much aware. I've mentioned already that the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, here clearly the earliest source to adopt this language, is in all likelihood also the oldest Tathagatagarbha source known to us. This supports my view that the discussion of this Buddha nature in terms of a kind of selfhood was not an alternative form of Tathagatagarbha doctrine, but rather belongs to its earliest expressions, which were either rejected or very carefully qualified by some later authors, likely opposed to any of this wading into the contentious waters of Atmavada discourse. This is where the texts in purple come in, making as they do reference to the Tathagatagarbha vis-a-vis selfhood, but making very clear that this does not itself constitute a kind of self. Specifically, but in subtly different ways, these texts contend that this term, Atman, is only applicable to how we conceive of beings after awakening. In other words, the Tathagatagarbha, as something that might be considered to transmigrate, is not something that could be called a self. I mention only in passing the texts in blue, which make no mention of the Tathagatagarbha vis-a-vis selfhood, and I think are something like doctrinally sanitized, maybe, from any mention of any resemblance to a doctrine of selfhood. The one text in green, the Lankavatara Sutra, is anomalous for several reasons, not least of which because it argues vehemently that the Tathagatagarbha doctrine cannot be confused for any kind of selfhood. But interestingly, that any resemblance it may have to such doctrines is only for the attraction of Atmavadin teachers outside of the Buddhist fold, those in this literature known by various forms of the term Tirthika, which we'll be seeing a lot more of. This term Tirthika, that is, something like one who dwells at a sacred ford, is certainly used here, as in many other Buddhist sources, as a generic term to refer to non-Buddhist teachers or ascetical practitioners who have in mind some notion of liberation from samsara, which is normally characterized by a preoccupation with the true nature of the self. We will go on to see that these Tirthikas are, I think, a key to understanding why some authors here adopted and defended the language of selfhood to espouse the nature of a Buddha in all beings. Today I'd like to focus on a couple of entertaining and unusual passages in the two, no doubt, earliest texts to propose this kind of Tathagatagarbha Atmavada. That is, once again, the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra and the Angulimala Sutra. Both are texts which boldly reimagine older Buddhist narratives, namely those of the Buddha's final discourse on his deathbed and the conversion of the murderous bandit Angulimala, and use these narrative frameworks for revealing what they both call the hidden teaching of the Buddha, that is, precisely the existence of the Tathagatagarbha that is properly one's own self. To foreshadow some of the material we're about to see, my argument is primarily that these Tathagatagarbha authors extend the influence of the Buddha over the activities and teachings of Tirthikas, in the manner that the Lotus Sutra imagines the great vehicle of the Mahayana to include also the lesser vehicles of the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha, considering them only to be provisional teachings. This interpretation is supported by another closely associated text here, that is the, and I have practiced this, Bodhisattva Gotra Paya Vishya Vikarvana Nidesha Sutra, which for the rest of this I might just call Bodhisattva Gotra, but anyway. In short, it seems that the likely earliest Tathagatagarbha authors not only contended that all beings can attain full liberation, but that all teachings aiming at release from samsara anywhere are ultimately productions of the Buddha. Non-Buddhist Atmavada discourse finding both its origin and, importantly, culmination in the Buddha's own account of a true self. We have available to us two Chinese and one Tibetan translations of the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, along with several Sanskrit fragments, which, while of course very important, unfortunately don't help us with these passages we'll see today. I'm presenting here mostly content from the earlier Chinese translation of Fatsiang and Buddhabhadra, but we'll draw attention to the second Chinese translation and also the Tibetan translation produced later in the 9th century. The Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra contends at length that the Buddha nature can properly be deemed a self, but it is also very much aware of how shocking and indeed unacceptable this may be to some audiences. This idea is elaborated in a series of parables, each of which seem aimed to answer some problems posed to the Buddha by Kashyapa, once again his main interlocutor in the text. So I want to demonstrate quite quickly that the authors of the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra were not naive in their adoption of a Buddhist Atmavada. Rather, they were aware of a range of objections that their audience had to this and listed these along with attempts to justify why this language was appropriate. On screen, we have a list of problems that Kashyapa has with the introduction of this teaching of the self by the Buddha. I should note that these don't constitute direct translations here, and these are drawn from equivalent passages across our three extant translations. I've inclined once, those which only feature in the later Chinese translation, and a second time, one problem that's only found in the Tibetan. The point is to show that our authors were aware of a wealth of conceptual problems with adopting this language. We get a glimpse here of what precisely our authors believe their audience to have considered a self to be. That is, some entity that is unchanging, free from forced death and rebirth, undifferentiated despite one's apparent birth, superlatively qualified, discernible within one's own constitution, and not subject to any kind of decay. The various parables of the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra attempt to confront one or other of these issues, and I don't find all of them, or that many of them, terribly satisfying, and in all likelihood the same could be said for their Indian audiences also. We remember that this was not the form of Tathagatagarbha doctrine that seems to have survived and flourished in India, having been very heavily qualified or outright rejected by later authors. Indeed, the self of this text has at least some of the features that we derive from this list. In the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, it indeed appears to be a permanent, unchanging subject that goes through transmigration. But importantly, the parables of this text each explain how this is perceived properly only by a Buddha. In other words, this model of beings as possessing a self is not meant to replace the older model of beings, constituted by the skandhas, but rather explains how a Buddha, from his awakened perspective, can perceive them. The more important point, from our author's perspective, appears to be how this might differ from non-Buddhist accounts of the self, which are always said to be still erroneous and incomplete. If the Buddha ultimately teaches something that can be called a self, how does this square with everything that is still to be rejected in the ideas of other teachers and schools? The last among a series of parables concerning the self is indeed more interested in the relationship between the Buddha's own use of the term Atman and erroneous musings upon the self, the ideas of Tirthikas, these extraneous religious practitioners or teachers, whom this literature always associates with wrong-minded views. As is the case with sutra literature, we don't want to overthink the parable, but instead should focus on its explanation that was meant to clarify its content for an audience. Nevertheless, the story is entertaining, especially in one of its variants, so is worth presenting in some summary. So this is what I'm calling the parable of the lost sword, which once again is the last parable in this text to talk about the true self. Two friends, a prince and a pauper, travel to a foreign kingdom. The prince has in his possession a marvelous sword. Now, this is the form of the story in our later Chinese translation and in the Tibetan. The underlying Indic term for the sword here is clearly some form of Sanskrit khadga or the Prakrit khaga, precisely because one of our translations, well, the earlier Chinese translation, instead understands the prince to be in possession of a tame rhinoceros. Some in the room may well be well acquainted with two senses of khaga in play here, either as a sword or a specific breed of rhino. At some point in the transmission of one form of the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, the story had been understood to have been about the latter. The message of the text remains the same, that there is something precious that has been lost. It's just in one case we have a sword and in one we have a rhino. I think it's more likely that the story was originally about a bladed weapon that would have been more easily carried and concealed than a rhino. But if you please, you can still substitute rhino at any stage for the rest of the story. So the pauper sees the sword before the prince departs with it from the kingdom. Then, having been heard to cry about the sword in his sleep, the pauper is summoned before the king, who desires it. The pauper then insists that though he has seen the sword, describing it as being like the horn of a goat, and you can imagine what the other one says here about the horn of the rhinoceros, he knows not where this sword is now. The king then dismisses the pauper and begins a kingdom-wide search for the sword. This king then eventually dies, leaving behind only stories about the sword, which is not to be found anywhere in his kingdom. Now, this is all well and good for the story, but what's of interest to us is, of course, its explanation. So, like that, prince, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, when departing from the world, explained for sentient beings the true self. The ignorant, hearing that all beings have the nature of a Buddha, didn't understand the truth of that and taught deluded imaginings, that the self is like a thumb-sized lamp in the heart, or variously sorts of sattva, atman, pudgala, or jiva. Pertinently, the Tibetan and later Chinese translations add that the self was understood to be the size of a fruit shell or of a millet grain sat in the heart. This is clear evidence that our authors were aware of imagery used in the Upanishadic literature to describe the self, being of one size or another, or situated here or there. We find here also lists of synonyms for what we might call the empirical self, repeated lists found earlier in Sutta literature and in the Prajnaparamita literature, lists which surely reject various names for the self used by one wrong-minded teacher or another. The explanation of the story goes on. Hence, like what was said by the pauper in his dream, This is transmitted and gives rise to all wrong views, imputing that there is a self and the search for the nature of the self. Not obtaining the real self, there is produced the teaching of non-self. Then all sentient beings in the world constantly produce deluded notions, imputing notions of an existent self and of non-self. Like this, good son, I say that the nature of the Tathagata is the supreme truth. The upshot here is that it should indeed be understood that some bodhisattva had previously taught a correct understanding of the self. This then is the root of all teachings of the self in the world, all of them now falling short of the true self, that is the Buddha Dhatu, again revealed by this sutra, but all of them owing their existence precisely to an original, dharmic knowledge of the self, which had been misconceived or misremembered. However, the last portion of the explanation goes slightly further, and makes the claim that I hold shows some debt of these authors to a Buddhological model that predominates in the Lotus Sutra. So this is the end of the explanation. If a worldly person expounds a self that is in accord with the Dharma, this should be known as being in contrast to worldly custom. It should be known that they are a bodhisattva emanation manifested in accordance with conventional speech. The Buddha again said to Kashyapa, all teaching, incantations, and treatises, the Tathagata is said to be the root of all these. This passage is strange, and we don't receive much more to clarify this from either of our other translations, including the Tibetan, which I'll put on screen in a moment. It seems to be the case, though, that our authors take very seriously the claim that whatever is well-spoken must belong to a Buddha. Anyone seemingly of the world, presumably outside any conception of the Sangha, who teaches a doctrine of the self still conversant with the Dharma, is singled out as being an emanation of, or by, it's unclear, a bodhisattva. Furthermore, anything of the above ideas or activities taught in the world, presumably it seems anything that has as its goal liberation from samsara, finds its foundation and derives any authority it may have from the Buddha. I add that the other Chinese translation states explicitly that the point here is that these teachings, incantations, etc. are of the Buddha and not of Tirthikas, if this needed making any clearer. This translation also states more explicitly that someone able to discern the self and teach it is precisely an emanation of a bodhisattva. So I present here the equivalent in the Tibetan translation, which is very similar. And I shan't read this, I'll just leave it there. In both translations, we find this idea of a bodhisattva emanation, corresponding in all likelihood to some form of nirmita. These are then magical creations of or by a bodhisattva. In the Tibetan, there is greater emphasis on this bodhisattva emanation being identified only of what is in all ways highest dharma, but this is absent in both Chinese translations and may reflect a later softening of this striking idea in a later form of the text. This is then a slightly different claim to that made just above, that is, that all doctrines of the self are misconceptions of an original teaching left by a bodhisattva. Here, whatever accords with Dharma, herein, of course, teaching the existence of the Buddha Dhatu, is to be attributed to some production, somehow, of a bodhisattva. Meanwhile, ideas and practices one might associate with these are also deemed to have their origins in what was originally said by a Buddha, or the Buddha. This passage, which culminates the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra's discussion of the true self, is odd, and if I read it correctly, makes a bold claim about the extent of the Buddha's influence in the world. Thankfully, we find a similar thought in a text very much indebted to the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, one which seems preoccupied to further address problems, and perhaps complaints, with the form of Tathagatagarbha doctrine that we find therein. So this is the Mahayana Angulimala Sutra, a text which has received very little attention in Western and indeed Eastern scholarship also. We have available only one Chinese translation, which will again be my focus here, and one in Tibetan. It is also cited only a few times by other extant Indian sources, and when it is, this is normally in its capacity as a text that espouses vegetarianism, a position held also by the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra. There's one important exception which we'll see in a minute. But the Angulimala Sutra tells us fascinating things about the development of Tathagatagarbha doctrine and early objections which likely postdate its possible origins in the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra. For example, it attempts to tackle the accusation that beings do not need to strive to follow the Dharma because they are, in essence, already awakened, an objection which isn't confronted by any of the more studied texts in this literature. For our purposes, though, this text also shines a light on what kinds of non-Buddhist ideas were known to our authors and perceived to be confusable with their own teaching of a Buddhist self. It also seems to once again suggest that all discourse about liberation is, once again, somehow indebted always to the influence of the Buddha. On screen now is a slightly crude compilation of all erroneous notions of the self that two versions of the Angulimala Sutra reject. I've provided specific Chinese or Tibetan terms where I think they're of interest. There's only one of these at the bottom that appears exclusively in the Chinese, whereas some of the above appear only in the longer account of this list that we have in the Tibetan. Again, it's clear that our authors were acutely aware of other conceptions of the self, many of which can be recognized from Upanishadic literature. For example, the idea that there is a self the size of a thumb is found in the Katha Upanishad, its comparison to various grains in the Chandogya Upanishad, the idea that it is something that pervades throughout the body in the Shvetasvata Upanishad. Comparison to a self that is of various colours isn't something that I find so easily therein, but we could have in mind the Jain system of Lesha, or different colours that are associated with a self at different stages of spiritual progress. So although our authors were clearly aware of different notions of the self, it might be that a number of them are heaped together here as views that are to be rejected. However, later in the text, the Buddha is asked how there came about not just conceptions of the self such as these, but precisely any Tirthikas, that is, those who espouse these erroneous notions. This is a question which I note seems to presuppose the idea that the existence of teachings outside of the Dharma needs some justification. The Buddha's answer is once again an amusing story, but this time not so much a parable as something like a mythic explanation of the origin of non-Buddhist practices, which all aim at liberation. I make this distinction because the story isn't introduced as an example or a point of comparison, but rather the Buddha simply begins to recount events of a previous kalpa, at a time when he states that there were no extraneous teachers in the world, and everyone, the text states, adhered only to the Mahayana. So this is what I'm calling, for reasons it will become clear, the myth of Buddhamati. So, the setting is the aftermath of the Parinirvana of the Buddha Kasantabhadra. I confess that so far I can't find any other reference to this Buddha in any lists of previous Buddhas. So far I only find it here, and as we'll see later, in one quotation of this passage in one Shastric text. If anyone has any other leads on this, of course, I'm interested. After the passing of this Buddha, there eventually remains only one stalwart practitioner of the Dharma, that is, a forest-dwelling monk whose name is Buddhamati. One day, Buddhamati accepts from a householder the gift of a beautiful robe, but unfortunately, this is witnessed by a group of thieves. These thieves kidnap poor Buddhamati, taking him off into the mountains, stripping him, and tying him to a tree. Then here's the important bit. Buddhamati's predicament, as it develops, is then witnessed by a series of passing brahmanas, who all emulate his behavior, thinking themselves to be seeing the last trace of the Siddharma being practiced in the world. So with what we're about to see, I base this first of all on the Chinese version of this text, and then we'll have a look at the Tibetan with its interesting variations. So Buddhamati's predicaments. First of all, a brahmana saw Buddhamati naked bound to a tree. Thinking this to be the Siddharma, he copied him, and thus arose the naked shramanas. Once Buddhamati was freed, another brahmana saw him covering himself with tree bark and ochre, making then a fly whisk to keep away insects. Thinking this to be the Siddharma, he copied him, and thus arose the renunciate brahmanas. In the evening, Buddhamati bathed himself in a river and covered his wounds with moss, and wore the discarded cloth of a cowherder. A wood collector, and I'm not sure why it's a wood collector, but it's in both of our translations, saw him, and thinking this to be the Siddharma, copied him. Thus arose brahmanas practicing austerities. Covered in scars and bothersome insects, Buddhamati then covered his body with white ash. He was seen by another person, who thought this to be, once again, the end of the Siddharma, and copied him. Thus arose the ash-smeared brahmanas. And finally, unfortunately, Buddhamati built a fire to treat his wounds, but as they became more painful, this became too much for him, and he hurled himself from a cliff. All of this was seen by another person who thought this to be the Siddharma, and copied him. Thus arose those who hurled themselves from cliffs and worshipped fire. Now, this is odd. I do find one reference to these particular ascetics in the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, but again, they're of some interest. Whatever else, it seems our authors were aware of and made distinctions between a range of different religious practitioners. I'll now bring up on screen, without going through all of them, the equivalent deluded souls that we find mentioned in the Tibetan version of this passage. We can be maybe sometimes more bold in assuming one Indic parallel or another here. For example, the first in the list are certainly Nigrantha Shamanas. Interesting here is that the Ashmir Brahmanas of the other text are explicitly here called Pashupatas, or perhaps rendering Maheshvarins. The fact remains this is maybe a more specific reference to Shaiva practitioners. I've been hunting with mixed success for references to all of these in Pali sources and elsewhere. I'm interested once again in any particular leads people might be able to suggest. The oddest of these is definitely the last, which we find just in the Tibetan. This seems to be a reference to those who think that the eighth stage of the Mahayana path, or at least some stage called achala, or unwavering, is a painful state that is to be pursued. Again, any leads on this are appreciated, it is quite odd. What we certainly see here is a fantastically imagined set of origins for a range of non-Buddhist practitioners. Their adherents, we should remember, are those whom are united by, if anything, a preoccupation with understanding the self or some other kernel to their existence which is wanting for liberation from rebirth. As we saw in the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, the Buddha of this Tathagatagarbha Atmavada text explains that extraneous teachers come about through some miscomprehension of what is or was once long ago taught as Dharmic. But we now take a look at the explanation of this passage, which focuses again on the Chinese translation. For example, a thirsty deer follows a false impression of a mirage, goes to it, and dies. When the Siddharma vanishes, notions of Dharma that are Adharma, caused by that monk, presumably here Buddhamati, again arise in this fashion. Like this, Manjushri, all that is produced in the world, superior conducts and various kinds of deportments that are produced, are all emanations of the Tathagata. When the Dharma is disappearing, then such things arise. In this way, the Siddharma disappears. Like this, Manjushri, regarding the real self, the world is like this, having perverse views and various different false notions, considering liberation to be like such and such, or the self to be like such and such. We'll see a Tibetan form of the above in a moment, but for now suffice to say that, as it appears in the Anglimali Sutra, as in the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, we find some form of the Tibetan Tulpa, which, Tulpa here of the Buddha, that is to say, a Buddha Nirmata, an emanation of the Buddha. Again, it seems that all superior things in the world are called emanations of the Buddha, which here I once again think refers to all practices which have in mind liberation. Can this mean, then, that they are purposefully permitted to exist in the world? The text makes clear that these practitioners, when they make recourse to the subject of the self, are of course always wrong, but nevertheless they seem once again to be products of the Buddha, presumably there for some pedagogical purpose. I mentioned earlier that reference to the Angulimala Sutra, as to the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, are rare in Indian texts. There seems to be only one citation of the Angulimala Sutra by any extant Indian source that doesn't refer to it just as a text that espouses vegetarianism. Importantly, this is a text that cites this very myth and presents us with one manner in which it was understood. This occurs in the 10th century Jnanasara Samuccaya Nibbandana by the Madhyamaka Buddhabhadra, which is a commentary on the Jnanasara Samuccaya by the Madhyamaka master Aryadeva. This text is predominated by an account of the differences between ideas of Sarvastivadins, Sautrantikas, Madhyamakas, and Yogacharins, all of which, of course, being Buddhist schools, with their differences, but ultimately are all here said to be superior to non-Buddhist perspectives. However, Buddhabhadra makes an appeal to his audience to show compassion to those outside of the Buddhist Sangha, despite their deluded mindsets. This text survives only in Tibetan translation, and I'm afraid it's a bit long to include the original text here, so I hope my English translation will for this suffice. So, hence having followed Buddhamati, monk of the perfectly awakened Buddha Kasanti, the time of the first Kalpa was grounded in the view of the gods of Jambudvipa. The views of Tirthikas that are produced, though being understood, should be opposed but not hated. It is said in the Mahayana Sutra, called Arya Angulimala, Manjushri, thus are performing worldly conducts and all practice rites also emanations of the Buddha. This is said by the Buddha so that those might become objects of compassion. So the Tirthikas should be confronted and challenged for their views, but importantly not hated. We mustn't forget that while these extraneous teachers are certainly always deemed wrong-minded by Buddhist authors, they are certainly at least in some sense high-minded to the extent that they make as their goal escape from samsara. Buddhabhadra states that the Buddha taught these to be emanations in order to make these beings objects of compassion. It does not seem then that Buddhabhadra was convinced that the Angulimala presented anything other than a provisional statement, nor we notice does he make any mention of the Buddhist doctrine of a self that frames this passage in the original text. However, this certainly proves to us that some audiences took the Buddhamati myth to be about the indebtedness of all so-called higher practices in the world to the Buddha. We return at last to the Chinese translation of the Angulimala Sutra and how the explanation of the Buddhamati myth ends. The culmination of this explanation is again revealing and a return to good, shocking form for audiences still incredulous that the Buddha indeed affirms, and for no provisional reason, that there exists a self. Therefore, the Tathagata taught the middle path of the Ekayana, which is apart from the two extremes, here of the worldly view of the self and supermundane denial of the self. The self is real, the Buddha is real, the Dharma is real, the Sangha is real. Hence is taught the middle way that is known as the Mahayana. I clarify here that the two extremes mentioned are, in some lines above, clarified as erroneous view of the self among the worldly, and then the denial of the self found among the supermundane. Seemingly here, those in the Sangha who reject this challenging form of Tathagatagarbha Atmavada. It is a recurring theme in this literature that many among the Sangha will not accept any of these ideas, especially that which would deem the Tathagatagarbha to be a kind of self. However, this self is here listed with the three jewels as what the Buddha certainly taught, and this is deemed indeed to be the position of the Mahayana. Notice, however, the mention of the one vehicle. This is the idea which may well have its origin in the Lotus Sutra, that there is ultimately only one vehicle, that is the Mahayana, which renders other vehicles, those of the Shravaka or Pratyeka Buddha, two goals belonging to pre-Mahayana Buddhism, only provisionally taught stepping stones towards the goal of full awakening. The Lotus Sutra is certainly earlier than all of the texts we are discussing today. It is mentioned by name in the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra and alluded to through this mention of the one vehicle in the Angulimala, and found throughout the rest of the Tathagatagarbha literature, which may well follow these two texts. Michael Zimmermann's conclusion regarding the influence of the Lotus Sutra on this tradition is strictly in terms of the Ekayana and the promise of the awakening for all beings, something that is realized and made sense of in the doctrine of the Tathagatagarbha. As the Lotus Sutra decrees that all beings will eventually attain full awakening, so does the Tathagatagarbha doctrine explain quite how this is possible, albeit due to the presence of afflictions, perhaps something that might take many, many lives. However, I go further to suggest that our author's use of Atmavada language, closely linked to their declaration of other teachings as nirmata of the Buddha or Bodhisattva, is to be read in the light of other pedagogical emanations or nirmata that are discussed in the Lotus Sutra. There's a lot on screen here, but I'll race through this as fast as I can. We have extant various versions and translations of the Lotus Sutra, but I'm here referring to the Sanskrit edition of Kern and Nangio. All I present on screen here are two uses of terms derivative of the verbal root nirma, that is to emanate or create magically, of which, of course, the past passive participle is nirmata. In the first passage, the Buddha recounts that he has emanated replicas of himself in one Buddha field or another, for the purpose of teaching the Dharma to sentient beings across worlds. In the second, the same language is used where the Buddha states that the parinirvana of other Buddhas, he meaning their apparent departure from the world, was similarly something emanated by the Buddha for the purpose of educating beings. The sense here seems to be that displaying these essentially eternal Buddhas as suffering death was only there for some pedagogical purpose. This is the important sense of all forms of nirma, I think, in this literature, the emphasis being not on the illusory nature of these creations, here both physical and pertaining to certain events in history, but rather on their function as pedagogical creations. As I read further into use of the term nirmata in other Mahayana sources, I'm convinced that the emphasis is always on their efficacy rather than their artificiality. Hence, when we find discussion of, for example, entities emanated by Mara, it seems that the emphasis is on their ability to be a threat rather than their being necessarily illusory. This language of emanation plays a central role in a parable of the Lotus Sutra that I think is most important to our understanding of the connection between this text and earlier Tathagatagarbha literature. This is the parable of the illusory city found in the Lotus Sutra. This famous parable recounts that the Buddha is like a guide who is to lead an expedition to a treasure kept in a faraway location. To ease the doubts of his companions, who see this terminus as being too far away, he conjures an illusory city at which they might be refreshed en route. Reassured, they set off, only realizing after having departed that it was only a construct. And I've extracted here from the explanation of that parable the one important use of this term, nirma. Regarding the education of beings, the Tathagata, knowing sentient beings to be of feeble nature, like the guide who produces the magically made emanated city so that those beings may have respite, teaches the two provisional inferior goals, that is, those of the Shravakayana and the Pratyekabuddhayana. I note that this is reference to the city in the story rather than what it represents, but the point remains that these are conceived to be analogous to the magical emanation in the story, and, as we saw in the examples just mentioned, in the real world the Buddha is thought to have indeed emanated some kinds of phenomena to further his pedagogical purposes. So in the vein of the Lotus Sutra, I believe that the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, and Angulimala Sutra want to represent extraneous teachers as precisely magical creations of the Buddha, which he allows to persist in the world for one reason or another. This is mentioned in both texts, where the matter of the Buddha's own teaching of the self is being justified, along with its distinction from, but most importantly, superiority to, other extraneous teachings. There is an older Buddhist tradition that the Buddha had in past lives taken rebirth as a religious teacher to fulfill one goal or another. For example, the Pali Mahagovinda Sutta, which culminates in the Buddha revealing that he had been the Brahmana to have first revealed the Brahma Viharas. There is also in the Mahavastu the suggestion that the Bodhisattva at the eighth stage emerged in the world precisely as a Tirthaka in order to teach what it calls Bhavasudana, that is, the destruction of rebirth. This is not, then, the only attempt by any Buddhist authors to explain extraneous religious teachers as having had some vital purpose, perhaps here the introduction of the idea of escape from samsara, prefiguring the re-emergence of the Buddha and his fully realized Dharma in the world. This understands these Tirthakas to teach something that is ultimately wrong-minded, but having some value, and more importantly, deriving any value it may have from the authority and influence of a Buddha. Interestingly, there is one final source, again in the doctrinal shadow of the Lotus Sutra, which considers extraneous teachers to be something like instruments of the Buddha. This is the, and again I'm afraid I'll abbreviate it, Bodhisattva Gotra Sutra, a text which again expounds the one vehicle in a very similar fashion to the Lotus Sutra. Also, though, in one of its surviving versions, it teaches the Tathagatagarbha. What is most remarkable about this text, which is called also the Mahasatya Nigrantha Sutra, is that its main speaker is a Nigrantha Shamana called Satyavadin, no doubt inspired by the Satchika of Pali Suttas, such as the Mahasatchika Sutta. So this is a Jain teacher who advises a king in the story, its other primary player, and is at the end revealed by the Buddha to be actually an advanced bodhisattva. In other words, this Satyavadin is very much a bodhisattva Tirthaka. This text is well versed in the one vehicle doctrine that we find in the Lotus Sutra, denying that there properly exist the two lesser vehicles of the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha, the ultimate truth only being the one expansive vehicle of the Mahayana. Having established this, the text then goes on to deny that there can be any Tirthakas in the world able to rival the Buddha. But clearly there are beings in the world that appear to be Tirthakas, teaching doctrines that attempt to challenge the Buddha's own Dharma. Even clearer, than the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra and Angulimala Sutra, this text then accounts for the existence of Tirthakas in the world precisely because the Buddha, imagined again as some kind of transcendent pedagogue, establishes them in the world. So, the important passage from this text. That place, in other words here, the Buddha field, does not generate Tirthakas and so on. Why is that? Manjushri, in my Buddha field, the presence of Tirthakas and Nigranthas is due to the sustaining power of the Tathagata for the purpose of manifesting the sphere of inconceivable skill in means. This sustaining most likely reflects some form of the Adhisthana, that is a maintaining of something in the world by the Buddha's sustaining power. Due to the mention of Upaya Kaushalya, or skill in means here, it is clear that this is always done with some pedagogical purpose in mind. And now final passage. This text then goes on to explain precisely why there are Tirthakas left in the world. Because all of these Tirthakas and so on are founded upon the gateway of inconceivable liberation. All are provided with great cognition and supreme perfection of insight. All have attained the power of great skill and means and vigorous mastery. All have attained non-abandonment of the recollection of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. All having reached the highest position, use their power to develop sentient beings. All have attained empowerment by the Tathagata for the purpose of teaching and developing these sentient beings. So, this then says something remarkable about these extraneous practitioners and what the authors of this text would have their audience believe them to both be and do. The suggestion is that these beings are secretly instruments of the Buddha, who actually contribute to beings moving steadily closer to the goal of full awakening. Secretly, because we must suppose that no real-world Tirthaka, confronted with such an accusation, would ever admit to being an instrument of the Dharma. Any contestation that they teach what is not the Buddhist Dharma must then be reimagined as something voiced only still for the purposes of advancing the Dharma. Hence, the real-world Tirthaka, outside of this text, is being rendered mute. Their activities, as we saw in the Tathagatagarbha text above, are subsumed within the expansive activities of the Buddha. As a text extolling the one vehicle, this Bodhisattva Gotra Sutta is certainly also very much influenced by the Lotus Sutra, and it also decrees that any extraneous teachers one may find in the world exist only because the Buddha establishes them therein. By power informed always by his skill and means, taking as its end, leading all beings towards the goal of awakening. What then does this say about the use of the language of Tirthikas, that is an Atmavada, that holds there to be something befitting the label self in the earlier Tathagatagarbha sources? Certainly this label seems well suited to the notion of a permanent, unchanging kernel in beings, which is of the same nature as the goal for which one strives, that is Buddhahood. But it was clear that our earliest authors faced objections from their audiences, and knowingly invited controversy. And as later Tathagatagarbha authors proved, couching this Tathagatagarbha in terms of an Atman was not strictly necessary. Surely we can imagine, as did, for example, the authors of the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, a doctrine of some lasting reality in beings that avoids using this taboo expression, and at least at face value, avoids confusion with extraneous teachings. So why then did some early Tathagatagarbha authors dare to couch this doctrine in Atmavada terms, pertaining to the realization of something deemed a self in the constitution of beings? It is this idea of a dominant, original, and indeed complete form of the self that is so interesting. The authors of the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra and Angulimala Sutra are keen to, on the one hand, distance their teaching of a self from those of others, but then accept that these must find their origin in misconception of the Buddha's own teaching. Furthermore, the ideas of these Tirthikas are permitted to exist precisely because, it seems, they prefigure the Buddhist Sadharma, the true Dharma, which here, of course, has at its centre the revelation of the Tathagatagarbha, this then being the correct, complete understanding of what can be deemed the self. All Tirthika doctrines, centred on the search for the true self, are then creations somehow of the Buddha, and find their correction, indeed completion, in the Buddha's own doctrine of the self, which is that of the Tathagatagarbha. Finally then, some consideration of why this model of religious teaching in the world, along with this adoption of Atmavada, may have come about. I don't believe that this account of extraneous teachers as Nirmita was the specific motivation for this adoption of Atmavada language for some of our authors. However, I think this reimagining of extraneous religious ideas, dominated as they were by the language of selfhood, to be indicative of an attitude underlying that of our authors, those responsible for this kind of Tathagatagarbha Atmavada doctrine. The Lotus Sutra is significant for reimagining the so-called lesser vehicles of the Sangha as provisional stages of the one vehicle of the Mahayana. This seems to have been deployed to express the superiority of its understanding of the Mahayana, herein an entire Buddhological paradigm, featuring, for example, the Buddha's continuing influence after his parinirvana, over the wider Sangha and its ideas. But why stop there? If such a device was used, presumably to undermine, through a kind of doctrinal inclusion, the doctrines of Buddhist rivals, could such a tactic be used also to undermine those who seem entirely outside of the Sangha? I don't believe that the target audience for these Tathagatagarbha texts were these foreign parties. Indeed, the whole polemic that they have is to discredit their ideas, and to do so in a manner that communicates both their inferiority and, importantly, the expansive influence of the Buddha over all discourse and practice aimed at liberation from samsara. With this high Buddhological paradigm in mind, the authors of this literature chose to colour their doctrine of a universal capability for awakening in all beings in the language of wider Indian tradition. By doing so, the Tathagatagarbha is not then one doctrinal expression among many, so much as the culmination of all discourse on the self, perhaps all discourse on liberation of any kind in India. All that came before it is then both originating in and prefiguring the Buddhist account of a self. As such, following Zimmermann, I hold that the doctrine of the Tathagatagarbha may have begun life in the wake of the ideas of the Lotus Sutra and its promise of the eventual attainment for all beings. However, following Michael Radich and his reading of the Mahaparinirvana Mahasutra, I believe the authors of this text and those of the Angulimala Sutra presumed what Radich has called a docetic Buddhology, that is, of the Buddha as an interventionist, transcendent reality that manifests one or other phenomena in the world for the purpose of advancing the Sadharma. But I think that more could be made of the kind of so-called docetic Buddhology that we find in the Lotus Sutra. This is one which wishes, through the doctrine of the one vehicle, to define the Mahayana as the correct name for all forms of Dharma. My suggestion is that the next development of this idea, for some authors at least, was expansion of the Dharma to account for all discourse pertaining to liberation from rebirth. So the Tathagata Garbha explains how all beings are host to the presence of a Buddha and are always inherently capable of realizing awakening. But couching this as a kind of self stresses that this is also that for which all other religious teachers outside of the Dharma have always wanted. The interesting spin on this is the suggestion also that these extraneous teachers only persist in teaching because of their having some utility for the ascetic Buddha. Perhaps, stated most explicitly by the Bodhisattva Gautara, because it is very much in the interest of our authors to explain away all perceived rivals to the Mahayana, further testament to the influence of this conception of the Buddha. These teachers, then, along with their ideas, have little to offer any audience already receiving entry into the Mahayana, and certainly pose no challenge to its ultimate superiority. This is due to their indebtedness to the expansive influence of this particular Mahayanist understanding of the Buddha and his activities, which certainly wants for further study. Thank you.